Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Robin Hood, as every American knows, would steal from the rich and give to the poor. Except when he didn't, says my guest today. The Robin Hood legend is very old, and it has changed and changed again in the new Hollywood version with Russell Crowe and Cate Blanchett. One critic calls it Tea Party Robin Hood. This hour on Point, we'll talk with a top Robin Hood scholar and a film historian about the many faces of Robin Hood. You can join the conversation. What comes to mind when you think Robin Hood? A cartoon fox, men in tights? Are you ready for a muscular, brooding Russell Crowe as Robin Hood? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll be joined in a moment by Robin Hood scholar Stephen Knight. We go first to San Francisco and David Thompson. The LA Times calls him the greatest living film historian. He's author of the new biographical dictionary of film and Have You Seen? A Personal Introduction to 1,000 Films. He saw the new Robin Hood film last night. David Thompson, it's great to have you with us. How was the film, sir?
Well, it's long. It's slow. There's a battle at the front. There's a battle at the end. There's a good deal of talk in the middle. It's one of the
apart
most,
from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the show?
It's one of the more cheerless Robin Hoods I've ever seen. They've kept the violence down enough to get a PG-13 rating, which obviously indicates that they're aiming at little boys who would like to have bows and arrows. Whether those kids will be held by the film, I have some doubt. They've made quite an effort to make you understand the look of 1200 and what life was like in 1200. And really, you don't want to be there. You know, it's not
a rough life. Yeah,
it's a rough life, and it's a sort of gloomy, rough film too, and there is a lot of violence, and it's been controlled. There isn't any torture, you'll be pleased to hear, but
though very nearly. I saw it earlier this week, and there is a little matter of a fire under a cabin full of people. Of course,
that really can't pass as torture anymore.
Yeah,
can
fair it? Enough. I guess I did see it earlier this week. It struck me as kind of a Braveheart in tights. I think
Braveheart is the model for it in many ways. Yeah, I mean, I think that film brought a new look to medieval cinema, and we're laboring with it. And Russell Crowe, he sort of seems to me to just pass through the film. I heard one of your promo people saying, a muscular, brooding Russell Crowe. He's not really very muscular. There's a moment where he strips down to the waist, and you get the feeling that there are some McDonald's or Burger Kings around wanting him at that time. He's a bit too fleshy, I think. As for brooding, I would call it more grumpy and disagreeable. It's not a film with a lot of charm or humor. I think Cate Blanchett does a fairly good job as Maid Marian, working very hard, and Crowe really doesn't work very hard in the film.
Cate Blanchett, anything she does sends me soaring, and I love her here, but there is some tension, I thought, between Russell Crowe, and he's just got a very heavy kind of specific gravity, the kind of a heavy maleness that works in part against that lighthearted merry men aspect that we've always thought of.
Well, merry is not a word one would use here, is it? No. And the whole feeling of the camaraderie of the forest and the band that I think most kids are raised on, and the memory of Doug Fairbanks and Errol Flynn, it's not there in this film. It may be that times have changed enough so that they'll get away with it. They'll be able to sell the film. But if it is a film for little boys of all ages, then I think some of them are going to be rather disappointed.
People talking about the political message here, wondering if it's a take from the rich and give to the poor or a Tea Party message. Let's play a little bit of Ridley Scott's new Robin Hood with Russell Crowe. He's an archer
loves England but bristles at the heavy taxes demanded by King John. And here's a scene where he arrives at a gathering of nobles and those who would fight to deliver some advice to the king. King John, who's there, who's trying to rally armies against a French invasion. Here's Russell Crowe as Robin speaking for an ailing friend.
I'm here to speak for Sir Walter Locksley.
Speak, if you must.
If you're trying to build for the future, you must set your foundations strong. The laws of this land enslave people to its king. A king who demands loyalty but offers nothing in return. You build a country like you build a cathedral, from the ground up. Empower every man, and you will gain strength.
Russell Crowe in Ridley Scott's brand new Robin Hood. David Thompson joins us from San Francisco, and right now with us as well from Cardiff in Wales is Stephen Knight, professor of English at Cardiff University, focused there on medieval culture. Wrote the book on the Robin Hood legend and its history, several actually. His latest is Robin Hood, a Mythic Biography. Stephen Knight, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's my pleasure.
So there's a little bit of the political message of this new Robin Hood, and yes. I guess every Robin Hood movie, sooner or later, apart from the merriment and fighting, gets to the political message. What do you think of what you've seen and heard of this one, Stephen Knight?
Well, listening to you and David makes me feel I'm going to see this one out of duty rather than pleasure.
Oh, it's not that bad, I'll tell you.
There we are. Okay. I was very interested in what you're saying about cheerless was David's word.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It's not just the films. Going right back, Robin is always a trickster. He doesn't only defeat the sheriff. He always outwits him.
Yes.
He makes a fool of him. And the sprightliness that those films that David was mentioning get so well is part of the meaning. And, of course, there are other aspects of it as well. Yeah, the politics is interesting, isn't it? So this is a sort of a little guy Robin Hood, is it? Man of the people, Yorkshire accent and all.
Yes.
It's been interpreted in the States, has it, as being a sort of an anti-centralist motif. That's what Tea Party means, I guess.
Yes, that's a piece of it. It's the politics were made a little bit ambiguous. It's hard to say, but that piece could be the don't tread on me anti-centralist message, yeah.
Yes, I see. Well, of course, the Robin Hood myth's always been able to be taken in all sorts of ways. I mean, he's a sort of, you know, he's noble, and sometimes he's noble in blood, and sometimes he's just noble in spirit. And it can be quite contradictory, even in the same period. And, you know, I would think that that's, in a sense, meant to be a sort of a Magna Carta-esque, you know, liberal-esque Robin Hood, but it is interesting it can be taken in reverse, as it were.
Now, I think I've seen you say that the whole idea of Robin Hood steal from the rich, give to the poor, isn't a kind of maybe an American spin on Robin Hood. Is that
true? It's a non-original spin, and it's certainly one that's meant a lot in the States. I mean, what we say is that, you know, if we go back to, say, the 15th century when Robin Hood first appears, he is a yeoman, he walks, he has a longbow, you can't fire a longbow from a horse, and he's a sort of man of the people in some way, representing natural justice. He's respectful of the king and of St. Mary, but his real enemies are the agents of king and the church. So he's against local officials' corruption. And he'll rob money from them, and he doesn't give it to the poor. He sort of, you know, keeps it for him and his guys.
Mm.
And the very striking thing is that towards the end of the 16th century, you know, under the Tudors, all sorts of centralisations going on, including against witches, as we know, this noble-hearted figure becomes made a noble man. So he now is still on the side of a true king, but he has to be against a false king. And this is when he gets put in the time of King John.
And he's an aristocrat, not the guy
right.
running around
he becomes
the woods.
Lord Robin.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually in the woods because he's been having trouble with the bad king.
Okay.
And this is when he starts taking from the rich to give to the poor. Charity. Now, America, and I've got a lot to say in favour of what America's done with this. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting to see if you agree, that Americans take Robin Hood as a sort of dissenter, you know, like a pilgrim father, you know, someone who saw what was wrong with society and moved on.
Yes.
And I think, you know, well-armed as well. This is a sort of American frontier sort of guy. And I think in America that it was more a redistribution myth than a charity myth. And has been quite important. Taking from the rich to give to the poor, if you blame Obama with that, then this is redistribution. So it's change in every period, and also, I think, in every country.
David Thompson, how about it? I mean, steal from the rich and give to the poor is if American
well, there
know anything,
very
they
much
know that.
Of that. But one thing that does figure in this film, and which I think is new to the films, is that King Richard is not presented as an unfailingly noble, honorable figure. It's made fairly clear in this film that the Crusades were an absurd and disastrous and depleting exercise. And there is a moment where King Richard, who is killed quite early, asks Robin, "Do you think the Crusades were worth it?" It's a rather contrived scene, but Robin demonstrates his courage and his independence by saying no. And he refers to a massacre of a thousand or so Muslims as a scene and a memory that he will never forget. And the king rather accepts this and says, yes, you know, I can see what you're saying. And in many versions of the story, Robin's allegiance to Richard is what assists him in fighting King John.
Not this
he
time.
He doesn't have that allegiance here at all.
Hard to have, and the next time you see him, he's in the stocks. We'll come back and look at that. David Thompson, please stand by in San Francisco, and Stephen Knight in Cardiff, Wales. We're talking about the legend of Robin Hood. Here's music from the 1938 version. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the legend of Robin Hood from Sherwood Forest to the big screen. Ridley Scott's big new Russell Crowe, Kate Blanchett version is out today. The story's been around for 500 years. In the new version, just out from Hollywood, Robin meets the widowed Lady Marian in Nottingham and agrees to pose as her husband so she won't lose her land. Lady Marian is not sold on the idea. Here's Kate Blanchett as Lady Marian with Russell Crowe as Robin.
It seems we are to share my chamber. A ruse to convince the servants.
Well, if the aim is deception, should you not be addressing me as my husband or my dear?
Don't be ridiculous. Well, are you coming or not?
Ask me nicely.
Please. Dear husband, will you share my chamber?
It's not exactly giggling in the woods, but it's the way things get going in Ridley Scott's new Robin Hood, there with Russell Crowe and Kate Blanchett. I'm joined this hour by David Thompson, top film critic and historian. He joins us from San Francisco. And by Stephen Knight, professor at Cardiff University, maybe the world's leading Robin Hood scholar, author of Robin Hood, a mythic biography, his most recent. Gabrielle is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Gabrielle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to, you know, pop in here. I've loved Robin Hood my entire life. I think his story sort of got me into archery. I now shoot a 6-foot English longbow.
Hey, May Marian, you.
But I was calling to do a little comparison. I think the Errol Flynn Robin Hood was absolutely the worst thing I've ever seen. And it sort of made a joke of the whole legend, I thought. One of the best ones I ever saw came out of an English TV show starring Michael Praed, where they brought a more spiritual context to what Robin was doing. They connected him with, like, Herne, the hunter in the forest, and they would sit at their meal in the woods, passing the cup of spring water around each other. It was a more spiritual connection to the people and the defense of the villages and that kind of thing, and not so much glitz and glamour. And Marian was a pretty good shot in that show, too.
There you go. So keep busy with your bow. Let us look back at some of these, Gabrielle. I appreciate your call. I mean, Errol Flynn the worst? Maybe, but then a lot of people rave about it. I've got a little tape from that, David. Stephen, let me play And here's a piece. This goes all the way back to 1938, The Adventures of Robin Hood. Errol Flynn stars as a pretty confident Robin Hood, motivated by his compassion for the downtrodden. He walks Maid Marian through a camp of displaced villagers in this 1938 clip. They've come to him for protection from the Normans, the French. Here's Olivia de Havilland as Maid Marian, trying to make sense of Errol Flynn's Robin Hood.
You're a strange man.
Strange? Because I can feel for beaten, helpless people.
No, you're strange because you want to do something about it. You're willing to defy Sir Guy, even Prince John himself, to risk your own life. And one of those men was a Norman.
Norman or Saxon? What's that matter? It's injustice I hate, not the Normans.
It's injustice I hate, not the Normans. The Normans, the French, come in for a big kicking in the new Russell Crowe version. David Thompson, how about the 1938 presentation of Robin Hood?
Well, I was sorry to hear that your caller...
Yes, me too.
thought it was so artificial. She's completely correct. It is entirely artificial, and I think that may be why I enjoy it so much. For me, that is the film that captures the sort of the childish enthusiasm for Robin Hood. I think most of us at a certain stage played Bows and Arrows and Robin Hood, and that's the movie that I think we were aspiring to. It's very silly. It's very innocent. It's very naive. It is quite beautiful. It is very early in the history of Technicolor, and the colors are just radiant.
Very green or blue. If
very
it's
green,
really.
Very blue, very red. There is also there is a wonderfully romantic, melodramatic score by Eric Wolfgang Korngold to it. And Errol Flynn, I think, captures the lightness of it perfectly. He doesn't take it terribly seriously. It's absolutely true. But for me, it's understandable that that's the film that has lasted the longest in popular culture.
Stephen Knight, you know, I'm reading here from a meeting of Robin Hood scholars just late last year. And here's one... Smith, yeah. And here's Marcus Smith, I believe, at Loyola University in New Orleans, saying, "I'm very quiet about this with my British friends here," he says, "but I think he, Robin Hood, is more American than British." What do you make of that claim, sir?
Well, I mean, as I said, I mean, I think America does make something of Robin Hood. Indeed, you pronounce it slightly differently, Robin Hood rather than Robin Hood. He's sort of been taken into your language. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Howard Pyle, the great illustrator and writer in 1883, his Robin Hood stories they're still being sold, and I think they're behind a lot of the movies. And Robin's not a lord in that. He's a very active, physical guy. But what I'd say is that that's another recreation, and I think as David talks well about the theatricality of the 1938 picture, and I go along a bit with what Gabriella said, because the early 80s new age, you know, student radical long-haired Michael Praed Robin Hood was a recreation that was very much in the spirit of its times. It had that new age element. It had the first electronic rock. It had folk electronic rock by Clannad on the soundtrack, which was, you know, in its way as striking as Korngold. So regeneration for each new set of audiences is what we find. And going back to what you two were saying before, maybe the Russell Crowe movie is, you know, the Robin Hood for our dark times.
Maybe so. It's an old, old story. Take us back, if you would, Steve and I, to the origins of this legend. Where does this come from?
Well, we hear about Robin Hood around the year 1400. Clearly, there are stories about him as an active guy, some sort of local resistance to do with the forest and archery. So he's a man of the people. We get poems recorded from the late 15th century, Robin Hood and the Monk, Robin Hood and the Potter, the sort of stories that you get in the movies and very much in the television series. And it's obviously a popular oral story that is finding its way into writing and print. And the 17th century, you get broadside ballads with the tune indicated, and these are all the, you know, one-on-one, Robin and Little John, Robin meets Maid Marian in the forest, that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's also a higher level of opera, operetta, and then in the 19th century, novels, none of which are very high in style. They're very popular. But he seems to mean to be a figure on people's lips. There are Robin Hood proverbs from early on. There's a very popular one: many men speak of Robin Hood who never drew his bow. he's got a sort of strange, mysterious presence. There are place names as well.
And what does that mean? Many men speak his name who never...
People go on about him as if they were tough, but they're not. Mm-hmm. Something like that. And they're also, very strangely, in the southwest of England, Robin Hood festivals in Maytime, where he is not an outlaw. He's a spirit of nature in the... He's just almost the green man celebrating. So he's a folkloric figure in some ways who gets brought into culture as this outlaw figure resisting bad local officials. And I think some of that, you know, utopian idea of natural law, a man of the people stands up for us, that's sort of part of the underlying meaning still, I suggest.
The green man you mentioned there, and I'm not sure all Americans will know, will follow that. I'm looking here, the Daily Beast writes, quotes Stephanus of Byzantium about myths in general, and looking to Robin Hood in particular, says, a myth is something that never was but always is. It seems to line up with your work on Robin Hood.
Well, that's why I call it a mythic biography. And the green man, the force of the forest, I think, you know, the Pathfinder, you know, James Fenimore Cooper's figures are American green men. The frontiersman is a sort of a man in touch with nature, and that's part of his true values, is the idea of the green man, I think.
One way you could redo the story, which I think might be very interesting and might come one day, is to play up that environmental side to it.
Yeah.
I mean, suppose Robin was a man who literally wants to protect the forest against all the inroads and all the things that can happen to forests. That would be a very interesting way to put it in a modern context.
There was a wonderful scene early in the Michael Praed series that Gabriella mentioned where little John is complaining about, oh, this is all cold here, miserable. And he says, why are we doing it? And Robin does a wonderful pirouette and gestures to the forest and says, for this!
in the TV series that some Americans may remember, that out of the 1950s, Terry in Brewerstown, Tennessee. Terry, you're on the air.
Yes.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do remember the Richard Green character from the 50s who... took from the rich thieves.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't steal from all the rich, just the rich thieves or the powerful that were using their power to
corrupt
hurt people, and gave the money back to mostly the people that it was taken from.
Can I say something about that TV series?
Yes.
Because I think it's interesting. This is a series that was done by commercial television in Britain in the 1950s, but in fact it was controlled by American production executives. And they got into the habit, into the pattern, of employing blacklisted American writers and directors from Hollywood. This was the time when a lot of those people were unable to work in Hollywood, went to England, people like Joseph Losey, and the show certainly had a real socialistic tinge to it sometimes, and it really did come from the fact that there were communists or ex-communists who were working on the show. I don't think the audience picked up on that, but if you look back on some of the episodes, it's quite striking how the parable is worked out.
Yes.
Stephen Knight, did you feel those politics at work there?
Yes, I think it's a fascinating example of some politics. There is, I think, David, one fairly early episode called The Informer. And,
This is in the McCarthy eras of blacklisting.
I don't know if David would agree with this, but, you know, he's spoken persuasively about the Errol Flynn picture as being very splendid and you know, theatrical. Some of us think that the Normans are represented very much like stormtroopers, and this is 1938, and there's a sort of a New Deal, Warner sort of liberalism element about it. Would you wear that as a bit of politics in it?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, there were a lot of films, and particularly out of Warner Brothers in the late 30s, that were trying to make some comment about the likelihood of a war in Europe and the need for America to get involved in it. That's certainly there, I think. And Errol Flynn was in a good many of those films.
Okay.
And here's a maybe not so political version. 1973, Disney's animated film Robin Hood. Little John is a bear. Robin Hood's a fox. Little John asks Robin Hood what he thinks about what they stand for.
You know something, Robin? I was just wondering. Are we good guys or bad guys? You know, I mean, are robbing the rich to feed the poor.
Rob? That's a naughty word. We never rob. We just sort of borrow a bit from those who can afford it.
Borrow? Boy, are we in debt.
They're Disney playing and messing around, trying to figure out the political theme of Robin Hood. Jim in Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. And guests. I just wanted to get a little bit more effusive about the 1938 version. And it wasn't silly. It was romantic. It mm-hmm. was fluff. But what a cast. What an incredible cast.
Olivia de Havilland, no less.
Errol Flynn. Yes. Claude Rains.
Yes.
Alan Hill, Sr. I mean, they were incredible.
And the director that went on to direct Casablanca.
Will. Who's the one who played Will? It was almost like he was a gay character.
He was a friend of Errol Flynn, wasn't he?
Oh, you've got me there. Don't know.
Remember the Will Scarlet?
Yes, I do.
Yes. Instrument
I can't
and
remember
kind of
the
poetic.
Actor.
Yeah. And he wore red, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you. I mean, I think it's the classic version. But it's a long time ago, and there's certainly room for other people to have a go at it.
Yeah, maybe different taste. Jim, thanks for calling. Stephen in Windham, Connecticut. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi. I think the Robin Hood themes are universal because it's the classic Main Street versus Wall Street. The steal from Goldman Sachs to give the Habitat to Humanity.
Yes, you're right up to date.
I think that they should have played more on the Iraq War theme, like how it broke the economy, how it's breaking our economy, and how in the Greek financial collapse. I would have played those themes a lot more. Like the 1938 probably played some of those Main Street Wars.
If you were Ridley Scott playing it right now, but then A.L. Scott in the Times today sees it as a one big medieval tea party. Stephen Knight, what about, the story that's told here is of Robin coming back from the Crusades. That's got a little bit of an Iraq element to it, and he's sort of disillusioned by all of that experience.
Yes.
And he's never waiting for King Richard to come home and save the day. King Richard's done and gone by the time things get deep into trouble.
That's right. One of the most interesting things, and Stephen just raised that there, is how the present gets into these medieval stories. The Crusades are never part of the medieval or the earlier story. There's no real mention of them. It actually wasn't a lot of interest in the Crusades in early English literature. They know we lost, for God's sake. But in the 19th century, there's a bit of imperial interest in the Arab world. But really, I think it's the 20th century. And in the Fairbanks picture, 1922, they're going off on Crusade and Robin returns. He's called back by Marion and they think he's a coward. You know, I associate this with 1922 American isolationism, We've just 4 or 5 years, we lost a lot of guys in Europe.
Right.
And the Crusades seem to have got closer and closer. The great Sean Connery, Nicol Williamson picture that Richard Lester did in 1976, I think David's mentioned, they're coming back from the Crusades and they're tired, they're tough, and they're coming back to sort it out. The Sherwood, Robin of Sherwood, that Gabriella mentioned, very interesting. He has the first Arab character, Nazir, joins the band.
Yeah.
They're trying to encompass these new forces. And the BBC series, recent one, is also Robin's returned. And they're saying, what are we doing out there? There's trouble at home. It's in a sort of idealistic way, talking about our world.
A kind of timeless story applied again and again to the contemporary story of the news and politics of the time. Stephen Knight, please stand by in Wells. It's so good to have you. David Thompson in San Francisco. Listeners, we're talking about the legend of Robin Hood from Sherwood Forest to the big screen as Ridley Scott's new Russell Crowe, Kate Blanchett version comes out today. You can join the conversation. What need, what longing does this story tap into? There's Mel Brooks' Men in Tights behind us. And did you play Robin Hood as a kid? Made Marian dream of running through Sherwood Forest? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
We're men. We're men in tights. We run from the rich and give to the poor. That's right. We may look like pansies, but don't get us wrong, or else look what I've got. We're men. We're men in tights.
Tights! Tights!
Always on guard, defending the people's rights. When you're in a fix, just call for the men.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the legend of Robin Hood. Ridley Scott's big new Russell Crowe, Kate Blanchett version is out today. The story has been around for 500 years. That's a long time in many, many versions and interpretations in different eras. Stephen Knight has tracked all of that in his great book, Robin Hood, A Mythic Biography. He joins us today from Cardiff in Wales in the UK. And from San Francisco, David Thompson is here, great film critic and film historian, author of the new Biographical Dictionary of Film. He just saw the new Robin Hood last night. He's not a fan. I think many people will be, but it is definitely not a merry story. It's darker than that, a kind of a Braveheart, I'd say. A.O. Scott calls it one big medieval tea party. Here's a little bit from the 1976 version, Robin and Marian. Sean Connery is a middle-aged Robin Hood here, ultimately commits suicide with Maid Marian at his side at the end of the show. It's hard to age as a hero, but here's a bit where he returns to Sherwood Forest. He's been disillusioned by the Crusades. He finds himself still bothered by the sheriff and his men, and here Sir Ranulph, the sheriff's sidekick, is mocking Sean Connery's Robin Hood and his rule of the forest.
You're the ruler, are you? Should I bow?
I wouldn't have you in my service. I've known your kind all my life. You're everything I meant to fight.
You're the enemy. You gobble good red meat, and we get bread and cheese. The laws can't touch you, and there's no crime you can be punished for. And we can shoot a deer and have our eyes put out. This is my forest. I'll live here as I like. You come in again. I'll kill you.
Sean Connery as Robin Hood there, and Robin and Marian, and Robin and Marian end up dead and side by side in that version of the story. David Thompson, what do you make of Sean Connery there?
Well, I like that film very much, and I think in a way it's the most authentically imaginative transformation of the legend into something a little bit different. And it was a surprising film when it came out, and you know, Connery is one of those people who can, he can certainly play the classic Robin Hood, but he has real depths as an actor, I think, and the feeling of middle age settling upon a man of action, a man of arms, and a man of integrity, I think work quite well in the film, so I have a lot of time for it.
We've got web comments here. Mercedes says, I saw the preview for the new Robin Hood and could tell about halfway through it could be very dangerous for Obama, whom I love, she writes. I guess she's feeling the Tea Party kind of don't tread on me theme in this version, though you could see it different ways, I have to say. Then John writes, I saw it earlier this week and enjoyed it. I know Robin Hood is a legend, but even the Disney version of the story was more historically accurate, if you can get past the talking animals, he said. Now, Stephen Knight, what about this issue of historical accuracy when it comes to Robin Hood?
Yes. I mean, I'm with David about the tone of the 1976 Connery Hepburn film. It had a wonderful medieval tone. Historicity is interesting, isn't it? Because the Ridley Scott film is claiming historicity when it's, you know, not really there at all. You know, the idea that, you know, Robin is involved in Magna Carta things, is Magna Carta was all barons. And it's as if to be historical is as card claiming authenticity. It's not only medieval, it's also true. But there is also, and I don't know if you want to raise this, also a bit of bugbear of mine, that quite a lot of, you know, historians want to talk about, was there a real Robin Hood? Mm-hmm. And my answer is, well, who cares, basically? It's a real myth. But the idea that something is authentic from the past somehow is used to give your reinterpretation a bit more clout, I think. And there is, I think the 76 picture is the one which the Russell Crowe picture should be judged against, both structurally returning from Crusade and also being realistic.
Well, this one is portrayed as a kind of prequel to the story we all know. It explains at some length, as David says, how he ends up angry and in trouble with the law in the forest. He comes back from the Crusades. Richard meets his end. King John is the bad King John, but there's no Richard to redeem once this all ends. But what about just the Richard and John history presented here, Stephen Knight? Is that, if Robin Hood's a myth, those two were certainly real kings.
Yeah, it is. But the point that David's been making about Richard being in this as a sort of not a very successful king is fascinating. Some years ago, I asked a great friend of mine, who's a great historian, who was the best king of England? And interestingly, he said George the VI. And I said, who was the worst? And he said Richard the I. He was useless. Mm. He was never there. He let it all go to
the best because he was gone in the Crusades.
Yeah, he was a nuisance, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lot. And actually, King John wasn't that bad. Good administrator, apparently. He was just vilified by the Tudors who wanted this bad king.
We should add also that the character of Eleanor of Aquitaine,
yes,
the mother of Richard and John, played by Eileen Atkins, is a very significant character in this film, and in many ways she is the best member of the royal family we meet.
And the tie between England and France, who really go head-to-head in the new version. Let's go to Pocatello, Idaho, and Jeffrey. Jeffrey, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering whether your guests were familiar with the writer Park Godwin and his interpretation of Robin that placed it a little further back at the time of the conquest by William with the Normans coming across, which has some of these same themes, but places Robin somewhere in the middle of being the surly Russell Crowe and the merry version that we're more familiar with.
Oh, it's a great question, Jeffrey. And in a way, Stephen Knight, this releases us from the shackles of American Hollywood versions, which is really only the last chapter here. What about the literary history of this?
Indeed. We're still in America, of course, because Park Godwin is a very fine American historical novelist, written well on King Arthur as well.
Right?
But that is right. It takes seriously the idea that Robin might be Saxon, which is an idea that Walter Scott invented, but has been important to people, and thinks through, well, what would it be like to have been a part Saxon responding to the Normans? And, it's a novel I admire. There is a sequel as well, which works strongly, but I think it's a very successful novel. And, of course, there are quite a lot of Robin Hood historical novels. And there are also, and this is a point I thought we've been getting close to talking about the films, there are quite a few recent feminist novels in which Marion comes to play a stronger role. Mm-hmm. Jennifer Robeson's Lady of the Forest is my recommendation. Robeson, not Robertson.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds to me as if Cate Blanchett is, you know, by both her glamour and her power, sort of realising this quite strongly in movies, which perhaps hasn't really been done before. Perhaps by Uma Thurman in the 1991 movie starring Bergen. I don't know what David would think about that.
Well, Kate Blanchett, no sissy girl
glamour,
in here. She's strong.
Glamour is not quite the word you'd use for Blanchett here.
Mm-hmm.
There are scenes where you see her farming, and those are interesting scenes because I think they are based upon some sense of how farming was carried out in those days. Mm-hmm. And she's a strong, tough woman. She has a sexy side to her, and I think you could hear that in that one scene, but she's a woman trying to keep the farm together, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And she is a feminist character, I think. There's no question about that. I was interested if Stephen could talk about this. What does Nottingham make of all of this? And what is Sherwood Forest like in reality?
Oh, good. Stephen.
Okay. It's still a pretty big forest, though nowhere near as big as it was. And it does have, and I recommend it, a visitor centre, which gives you a look at it. Nottingham, one of the things Nottingham worries most about is that there is also a Yorkshire Robin Hood. The very early stories place him in Sherwood near Nottingham, but also in Barnsdale near Doncaster. And I have to say that Doncaster Airport has called itself Robin Hood International Airport, which is caused a bit of bother down Nottingham way.
Right.
And the really interesting thing is that the early Robin Hood is not only in Nottingham, he's also in Inglewood next to Carlisle. There's a Windsor Forest Association. It really seems he's almost a sort of, this is the Green Man back again, he's in the forest next to a town. He's never in the Highlands, he's never in North Wales. He's always just across from where we are, an available space of freedom in a forest, naturalness. And I think Nottingham came to dominate because it was such an important central town. know, this is where King Charles raised his standard in the beginning of the Civil War, mm-hmm. and everything goes through Nottingham, and it became the default Robin Hood place. And he's still quite proud of Robin Hood. I think there's Robin Hood tourism, but there is a debate with Yorkshire.
Well, you never know that in the United States. It's all Sherwood Forest and Nottingham here. Salt Lake City, Utah. Rod, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I'm a great fan of yours. I listen every day that I possibly can. And I just had to call in on this show because I have the whole British Empire behind me. My mother was born in Boston. Her mother was born in Australia. Wow. And my father was born in Canada. And he worked on the Errol Flynn version of Robin Hood. You know, that was filmed in Bidwell Park in Chico, California.
Okay.
And,
wow.
Yes.
And your dad was on the set. What did you think of Errol Flynn?
Well, he didn't like Flynn very much because he was kind of a highbrow, but he had a lot of political debates with that great big guy that played Little John.
Don Hale.
My father was very political and pretty much to the left, and so he had a lot in common with the big guy that played your guest there will know the name of that actor that did
the actor was Little Alan John. Hale.
Marilyn?
Yes.
Hale.
He played Little John three times, didn't he, David?
Yes, yeah.
Strange achievement.
Rod, you take us right back there. Thank you, Rod. And remind us, Stephen, David, I mean, in the 30s, these talk about politically active times. These were really loaded, politically loaded times. And there the debate going on right on the set of the filming.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of amazing.
Flynn wasn't part of it.
Yeah, wonderful.
I was fascinated to hear your correspondent there talk about the imperial stretch, because I used to work in Australia, and Australia and New Zealand have made considerable contributions to it. Flynn was an Australian, Crowe is a New Zealand come Australian, Blanchett is an Australian. This is and it's very curious, and none of the big Robin Hoods in film, I think, have been English. Richard Green was an Irishman. Connery is a Scot. You have any views on this?
The only Englishman I can think of who played the part was Richard Todd. There is a version in the early 50s,
is true.
Isn't there?
That's right.
He was English. But I think you're quite right otherwise. I wonder, do you think that the Australian story of Ned Kelly, which is... I mean, that's certainly a real story.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a version of Robin Hood too?
Well, it's a real outlaw story. And interestingly, in Australia, Robin Hood was pretty popular and the songs were quite well known until by the mid-19th century, they generated their own outlaw heroes. Morgan the Bushranger, Jack Donohue, and of course, Kelly, the real outlaw. But Kelly saw himself as an Irish version of that outlaw figure. But it was well known, and some things you two guys have said before, it's an international story. Wherever I go, I always say, who is the outlaw? And there's always a local outlaw whose name I've never heard of, but they also know Robin Hood. He is the sort of the international all-purpose, fits-all-versions outlaw. Yeah.
Maybe the original, I don't know, gangster. Let's go to Tony in Randolph, Massachusetts. Tony, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
First, a quick point. I wanted to say I love the TV series. I think it was from back in the 60s. Starring, was it Richard Green?
Yes.
Mm.
I loved that series when I was growing up. But I want to draw some parallels between the story of Robin Hood and, of all things, some Christian archetypes. Look at the Maid Marian as a parallel with the Virgin Mary. Little John, who Robin met on the river crossing, as a parallel with John the Baptist, who baptized people at the river. The Sheriff of Nottingham is Pilate. Prince John is Herod. Look at Robin himself, perhaps, as Jesus. And maybe King Richard is, the long-awaited second coming.
Tony, let us pick it up. Our time is short. Yeah. I saw some French paper writing right along these lines in response. This is a pretty anti-French film right here, but I guess it would hardly be surprising over all these centuries if all this cultural... what these cultural neighbors got mixed up, Stephen.
Yes. Tony's got a real point here. There is a famous book by Lord Raglan, who's an anthropologist, called The Hero, and he compares international heroes. Jason is one, Arthur is another, and they all do similar sorts of things, and indeed Christ is one of those, though he has a special role, of course, in Western culture, and Robin Hood is as well. Robin Hood doesn't have the... We don't know about his birth. Most of the heroes have a mysterious birth. Perhaps they have two fathers, one human, one divine, but right. Robin Hood does have quite a lot of overlap with this model of the international hero, and those are very interesting points that Tony was making.
Here's a little bit from the new film. Russell Crowe's the archer who knows little about his past in this telling. Fate brings him to a man who knows his past. Here's Max von Sydow as Sir Walter Locksley telling Russell Crowe's Robin about his father.
Your father was a philosopher. He had a way of speaking that took you by the ears and by the heart. Finally, hundreds listened, thousands, who took up his call for the rights of all ranks, from baron to servant.
Rise and rise again. Until lambs become lions.
Until lambs become lions, that might be right along with Tony's angle on this story. Stephen Knight, it changes and changes again. As you say, it changes for every time. Certainly, this is not a story that's finished. Probably never go away.
No, it seems to change about every generation. There's a different version, sometimes in a different mode, and maybe our future versions will be in more electronic mode. but yes, we can, if we had 10 hours, we could go right back every generation and see it changing. And I think it's because it's such a flexible story. Unlike the King Arthur story, there's nothing you have to have. You have Robin, a forest, a bow, probably Little John, maybe not Marian, usually the sheriff, and then you write it. And so what's in around you as you write it gets into the story.
Well, Friar Tuck does show up in this version with a little, honeybee-made mead there, which brings what merriment there is. It's a darker one. I think a lot of people, David Thompson, these days will probably go for it. It's in the vein of many shows which have been pretty big, but not a lot of merriment here. I'm so grateful to each of you for being with us this hour. David Thompson in San Francisco, author of Try to Tell the Story. Thank you very much, David, for your time today.
A great pleasure.
And Stephen Knight in Wales. Thank you, Stephen Knight, for joining us.
My pleasure also.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.